This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by PDS Debt.
The year was 1947. America had the bomb. The Soviets didn't. But that was about to change. The next war would be nuclear. Protecting state secrets was more important than ever. But President Harry S. Truman was hiding something bigger than the atomic bomb. In July, a craft crashed in the New Mexico desert. The wreckage wasn't Russian. And the bodies weren't human. Truman formed a committee of 12 men. Their job? Create a government within the government and use that government to guard the most important discovery in human history. And for almost 40 years, they did, until the last one died. That's when the world would finally learn about Majestic 12.
We are the knights who say...
Good morrow, human. I summon thee with grave urgency.
Why are you talking like that? Are you hanging around the local theater again?
Nay, peasant, I hath opened mine own royal franchise, Lord Hecklefish's Greasy Pickle Poke, where the pickle is in the meat and the grease is extra wet.
Grease? Pickle meat?
Aye, ye old pickle meat. Grease thy meat, human.
Stop saying that. What is the emergency? I have a script to write.
At first the kingdom rejoiced, peasants flocked, knights gnawed, wenches moaned. Even the jesters were double-fisting turkey legs and greasy pickles. But lo, I declared myself lord of the fair, and with great power came great irresponsible spending.
Just talk normally, please.
I'm in freaking debt, human. Real debt. Apparently ye old platinum scroll is tied to my actual credit cards. I need you to come down to the Ren Fair and throw me 1 million shillings.
No way. You need a knight in shining armor. You need PDS debt.
Oh, I see what you did there.
I sure did. It starts with one missed bill, then another. Suddenly your mailbox is full of final notices. Debt collectors want your car, your home, your paycheck, your peace. Debt doesn't wait. It destroys. But there's a way out. PDS Debt has helped hundreds of thousands escape before it was too late. They go beyond the numbers to understand your situation and create a personalized plan. And there's no minimum credit score required. PDS Debt is here to help you save more, pay off debt faster, and start putting money back in your pocket. They're A-plus rated by the BBB and have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Proof that PDS Debt is a trusted solution for people who need real help. Look, we've all been there. Debt is overwhelming. The interest piles up and you feel stuck. If you're dealing with credit card debt, personal loans, medical bills, or collections, don't wait. You're 30 seconds away from being debt-free. Get your free assessment and find the best option for you right now at pdsdebt.com/files. That's pdsdebt.com/files.
pdsdebt.com/files.
That's right.
Huzzah! With no more debt, I can finally host the grandest of tournaments, the Pickle Joust.
I don't even want to ask.
Two knights, one field, and instead of lances, they ride forth with mighty pickles. I gotta go, human. The wenches are oil resting in the turkey grease again. I'll be right there, ladies!
On December 11th, 1984, a package arrived at Jamie Chanderay's Hollywood office. No return address, no note, just a roll of 35mm film. Chanderay was a film producer working on a UFO documentary with researcher Bill Moore. Moore had written The Roswell Incident in 1980. Before his book, nobody knew the real story of Roswell. He had sources, military contacts, people who leaked information, but nothing like this. Chanderay called Moore. Within an hour, they were in Chanderay's bathroom.
This story took a weird turn.
He used his bathroom as a darkroom? For developing photographs?
Okay. We're back on track.
Under the eerie red light, the first image appeared. They didn't know what to expect. They certainly didn't expect to see the presidential seal.
Magic seal fetus?
Wrong episode.
Link down in Mills Hole!
There were a total of 8 photos, all documents. The first page was labeled Top Secret, Magic Eyes Only. This was a security classification they'd never seen before, supposedly 2 levels above Top Secret. The formatting was perfect. The typeface matched 1950s government standards. The terminology was right. The dates were right. And the names, those were definitely right. 12 names. A committee tasked with managing the most sensitive secret in American history, Operation Majestic 12. Moore recognized every name on the list, military leaders, intelligence officers, scientists. But the last name was most interesting, Dr. Jerome Hunsaker. Hunsaker had died 2 months ago. He was the last survivor of the original Majestic 12. The timing wasn't a coincidence. Someone waited until the last man was dead. After almost 40 years of secrecy, somebody wanted this exposed. Moore had literally written the book on Roswell, but his information was secondhand accounts and local legends. He had no hard evidence, until now. The 8 pages told an explosive story. A UFO crash in Roswell, recovery operations, advanced technology, and alien bodies. The documents proved that the U.S. government covered it up, and they proved Roswell was only at the beginning. Jamie Chandray and Bill Moore held proof of the biggest cover-up in history. The documents detailed a secret committee called Majestic 12. But the real shock was why the committee was formed. The main document was a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower, November 18, 1952. The subject line, Briefing Document, Operation Majestic 12, prepared for President-elect Eisenhower, eyes only. On September 24, 1947, Truman signed Executive Order 092447. It created a special committee to handle all aspects of extraterrestrial interaction. 12 members, scientists, military leaders, intelligence officers, all with the highest security clearances, all sworn to absolute secrecy. The committee had 3 purposes: study recovered technology, develop strategies for future contact, and most importantly, keep the entire operation hidden from the public. The committee was a response to events that began in June 1947.
On 24 June 1947, a civilian pilot flying over the Cascade Mountains in the state of Washington observed 9 flying disc-shaped aircraft traveling in formation at a high rate of speed. Although this was not the first known sighting of such objects, it was the first to gain widespread attention in the public media.
Though they denied it at the time, the military had been seeing a lot of these objects.
Hundreds of reports of sightings of similar objects followed. Many of these came from highly credible military and civilian sources. These reports resulted in independent efforts by several different elements of the military to ascertain the nature and purpose of these objects in the interests of national defense.
Witness statements were confusing. Nobody knew what these things were. Then on July 7, 1947, an object crashed in the New Mexico desert. The official story? It was a weather balloon. That was a lie. The briefing described a craft of unknown origin. Metallic, disc-shaped, about 30 feet wide. No visible seams or rivets. No visible propulsion system. Made from a metal alloy they couldn't recognize. The report confirmed this was engineering beyond any country on Earth. But the craft was empty. But that changed a week later when they found 4 bodies.
Aerial reconnaissance discovered that 4 small human-like beings had apparently ejected from the craft at some point before it exploded. These had fallen to Earth about 2 miles east of the wreckage site.
4 bodies, about 4 feet tall. Humanoid, but definitely not human. Large heads, no hair, gray skin. 3 died on impact. The 4th survived the crash, but died shortly after. The military moved fast and created the infamous cover story.
A special scientific team took charge of removing these bodies for study. See Attachment C. The wreckage of the craft was also removed to several different locations. See Attachment B. Civilian and military witnesses in the area were debriefed, and news reporters were given the effective cover story that the object had been a misguided weather research balloon.
The scientific team, led by Dr. Detlef Bronk, called the beings extraterrestrial biological entities, EBEs. And Roswell wasn't an isolated incident. The briefing detailed a 2nd crash.
On 06 December 1950, a 2nd object, probably of similar origin, impacted the Earth at high speed in the El Indio Guerrero area of the Texas-Mexican border after following a long trajectory through the atmosphere.
The object was almost completely destroyed on impact. What remained went to the Atomic Energy Commission facility at Sandia, New Mexico. The briefing included the names of all living MJ-12 members, powerful figures in the military, scientific, and intelligence communities. But one name seemed out of place, Dr. Donald Menzel, America's most famous UFO skeptic, a man who spent his career explaining away every sighting as weather balloons, swamp gas, or natural phenomena. Having the country's biggest UFO debunker on the original committee proved that Operation Majestic 12 wasn't about discovery. It was about deception. The MJ-12 documents described a crashed UFO and four alien bodies. But the most shocking part wasn't the crash. It was the cover-up. One name on the committee proved the operation was designed to deceive the public from the very beginning. The roster of Majestic 12 reads like a who's who of the American deep state. Let's go through the names. Admiral Roscoe Hillencoder, Naval Intelligence, First Director of the CIA, designated MJ-1, reported directly to the president. Admiral Sidney Sowers, Naval Intelligence, First Director of Central Intelligence, later Executive Secretary of the National Security Council. General Hoyt Vandenberg, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, oversaw Air Force Intelligence, became the second Director of Central Intelligence. General Nathan Twining, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, commander of the Roswell operation. He wrote a famous memo in 1947 saying UFOs were real. From his reports came Project Sign, Project Grudge, and Project Blue Book. Secretary James Forrestal, First Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of the Navy. General Robert Montague, commander of Sandia Base in Albuquerque, which created nuclear weapons. Captain Gordon Gray, National Security Advisor under Eisenhower, Secretary of the Army, helped manage nuclear weapons policy. Then the scientists. Dr. Vannevar Bush, head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development during World War II, architect of the Manhattan Project. Dr. Detlev Bronk, biophysicist, future president of the National Academy of Sciences, specialized in aviation medicine, in charge of non-human biological entities. Dr. Lloyd Berkner, physicist and engineer specializing in radio, atmospheric studies, and space science. Dr. Jerome Hunsaker, aeronautical engineer, chairman of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which became NASA. These were the men who built America's nuclear secrets, but among them was one name that didn't fit, Dr. Donald Menzel. Menzel was a respected Harvard astronomer. He was also America's most famous, most vocal UFO debunker. He wrote books explaining away every sighting as weather balloons, swamp gas, mirages, all kinds of natural phenomena. Having such a well-known skeptic on a UFO committee made no sense, unless his public role was a cover story. Dig a little deeper, and you realize Menzel was living a double life. He had a 30-year association with the NSA. He had top secret ultra clearance with the CIA.
Top secret ultra clearance. What's next? Super duper premium platinum pinky swear clearance?
Between 1947 and 1948, right after the crash, Menzel made several trips to New Mexico, all paid for by the U.S. government. In public, Menzel was a skeptic. In private, he was an asset. Harvard University has been taking photographs of the sky since 1882. The images are stored on photographic plates. By 1952, Harvard had 500,000 plates. Many contained images that would be inconvenient for the government, so they had to be destroyed.
One third of the plate collection destroyed by the new incoming director of the Harvard Observatory. And that man was, do you give his name or shall I?
I think you should do it.
That man is Dr. Donald Menzel.
Dr. Menzel destroyed 150,000 priceless photographic plates, images of Mars, the moon, the entire sky. Not only that, he prevented Harvard from taking any additional photographs during his tenure, 15 years.
So Menzel comes in September, October 1952, but began destroying a certain amount of this priceless collection of astronomical data. And also, he prevented Harvard from collecting new astronomical data for a certain number of years. And this is known among your colleagues as the Menzel Gap. Is that correct?
Yes, the survey that was there, like the old sky survey, was halted for 15 years.
Oh, so following the science means destroying evidence, eh? There's a lot of that going around these days.
But Menzel wasn't the only member with a complicated story. James Forrestal was openly critical of government corruption and lack of transparency. A man with a conscience isn't suited for a seat at the most secret table in the world. For MJ-12, Forrestal was a problem. To solve it, all they needed was a little gravity.
Oh, no.
James Vincent Forrestal didn't come from old money or privilege. He clawed his way up from newspaper reporter to Wall Street millionaire. By age 40, he was president of the powerhouse investment firm Dillon Reed & Company. When World War II broke out, he walked away from finance to serve his country. Roosevelt made him Undersecretary of the Navy, then Secretary of the Navy, and finally First Secretary of Defense. Forrestal oversaw the transition from wartime America into the Cold War superpower. His rags-to-riches story was the American dream, but he was the nightmare for the Washington establishment. Forrestal was openly critical of Truman's policies, nuclear disarmament, joining NATO. Forrestal argued that recognizing the new state of Israel too soon would inflame the Arab world, threatening U.S. oil security. Critics accused Forrestal of being anti-Semitic, but the record shows his arguments were strategic, not religious or ethnic. He wanted Israel to be under UN control until tempers in the region cooled down. He also believed America was being hollowed out from within. He warned that communists had infiltrated the government, the media, and the military. While the U.S. was disarming, Moscow was embedding agents at the highest levels of American life.
He was right about that.
He was. Congressional hearings would later prove that Soviet spy rings really had penetrated Washington. But when Forrestal said it, he was branded paranoid. It was a media smear campaign. Journalists who once praised him painted him as unstable. Communists accused him of imagining reds under every bed. Cartoonists mocked him as a wild-eyed conspiracy theorist. Inside the White House, Truman's circle spread the idea that Forrestal was cracking under pressure. They circulated rumors about his drinking, about his memory. But Forrestal wasn't drunk or senile. He was filling thousands of pages in his diaries, working 15-hour days. He was independent, wealthy, and wasn't afraid to speak truth to power. Forrestal couldn't be controlled. That made him dangerous. By March 1949, the pressure campaign worked. Forrestal was forced to resign as Secretary of Defense. Within days, he was checked into Bethesda Naval Hospital for rest. But that rest looked more like confinement. Visitors were restricted. His priest tried 7 times to see him, blocked every time. His brother Henry begged to bring him home. Even Forrestal wrote letters saying he was fine and wanted to leave. The Navy kept him inside. 7 weeks later, he was dead. At 1:50 a.m. on May 22, 1949, a nurse heard a crash outside. Forrestal's body was found on a third-floor ledge, 13 stories below his window. The belt of his bathrobe was tied around his neck. The hospital declared it a suicide within hours. No autopsy, no investigation. The coroner rubber-stamped the report without inspecting the body. Reporters were told Forrestal had been copying lines from a tragic play as a suicide note. But the lines were unfinished, mid-sentence, as if he was interrupted.
Now, let me guess. The video wasn't working that night.
They didn't have video back then.
Yeah, likely story.
Forrestal's brother Henry called it murder. Navy officials ordered personnel to stay silent. They even classified the number of windows in his room as top secret. Forrestal's diaries were seized immediately. Thousands of pages of meetings, conversations, personal reflections. When they were finally released 2 years later, entire sections were missing. His family believed the censored passages contained secrets that powerful people wanted buried. Instead, Forrestal was buried.
History seems to repeat itself, don't it?
It does. Some believe Forrestal was going to go public about UFOs. He felt Americans deserved to know the truth about extraterrestrial contact. But the message was clear. Silence wasn't optional. For years, the trail stayed cold. Then, a postcard arrived from New Zealand with a return address in Ethiopia. With James Forrestal dead, the MJ-12 secret was safe for years. But in early 1985, a mysterious postcard arrived at Bill Moore's home, about to blow the case wide open. The postmark was from New Zealand. The return address was from a post office box in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Moore didn't know anyone in New Zealand or Ethiopia.
When doors won't open, search for windows. Add some zest to your trip to Washington. Try Reese's Pieces. For a stylish look, shop Suitland.
Oh, whoa. I hope they paid for all those product placements in this video.
The message on the card was a riddle.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
Someone was following the investigation and knew it had stalled. Moore called Jamie Chanderay and their new teammate, nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. Friedman had worked on classified nuclear aircraft programs for companies like General Electric. He approached the documents like a scientist and helped them crack the code. They worked backwards. For a stylish look, shop Suitland. Suitland wasn't a clothing store. It was Suitland, Maryland, home of the National Archives. That unlocked the other clue, Reese's Pieces. At first, they thought it had something to do with extraterrestrials. After all, they were E.T.'s favorite candy. But Friedman knew an Ed Reese who worked at the National Archives in the military records branch. Reese's Pieces weren't candy, they were documents. The postcard was telling them exactly where to go and who to see. 3 days later, Moore and Chanderay were in the massive archives building in Suitland. They were still facing millions of documents with no idea where to start. Then Moore looked at the postcard again. The return address, P.O. Box 189, Box 189. Chanderay approached the reference desk. They were looking for Box 189, Record Group 341, Air Force Records. The archivist checked the computer. The box had last been accessed in September 1984, just 2 weeks after Jerome Hunsicker's death. About the same time, Chanderay received the Majestic 12 documents.
Yahtzee! This is like some UFO scavenger hunt, like Midnight Madness! Fagabeefy.
I know the movie! Do you want to know what they found in the box?
What's in the box? Okay. I'm done. Really, seriously. What's in the box?
Inside.
Fagabeefy.
Inside were dozens of folders filled with routine Air Force business from the 1950s. Then Chanderay found it. A single sheet of paper tucked between budget reports. The header read, Top Secret Restricted Information. A memorandum from General Twining, signed by Robert Cutler, President Eisenhower's special assistant.
The president has decided that the MJ-12 SSP briefing should take place during the already scheduled White House meeting of July 16th.
This was it, the smoking gun, an official government document referencing MJ-12, filed in the National Archives. It was the final piece they needed to solve the Majestic 12 puzzle. But Moore, Chanderay, and Friedman weren't exposing a secret government program. They were being manipulated by one. Moore, Chanderay, and Friedman thought they had found their smoking gun. The Cutler-Twining memo seemed to be the proof they needed, but they didn't realize they were pawns in a much larger game. The clue was on that first envelope that contained the film. It was postmarked Albuquerque, New Mexico. Kirtland Air Force Base is in Albuquerque. That's where the game was being played, and the man in charge was Richard Doty. Doty was a special agent for AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. His job was to spread disinformation in the UFO community. And he was very good at it.
I was always connected to UFOs and to disinformation, although in actuality, within the government, we don't call it disinformation. We call it deception operations.
Doty's most notorious target was physicist Paul Benowitz. Benowitz believed he was intercepting alien communications near Kirtland. Instead of dismissing him, Doty fed him false documents and encouraged his theories. Eventually, Paul Benowitz had a complete mental breakdown. We did a whole episode on this a couple of years ago.
Link down in your Venus flytrap.
We don't want him to go out to the public, go on camera and say, hey, I just tapped into a secret laser on Kirtland Air Force Base. Obviously, we can't have that happen. So all I had to do was say, well, you know what, Paul? Maybe what you did see was UFOs.
Doty wasn't just targeting civilians. He also manipulated Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker Linda Moulton Howe. She was working on a UFO special for HBO. Doty promised her footage of crashed UFOs and alien bodies.
She also had contacts within the government. Mm-hmm. We wanted to know who those contacts were. So we set up an operation. We didn't. I didn't. Mm-hmm. The government did. Where I would bring, she was coming to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So everything was set up for me to contact her, bring her in to the OSI office, and show her a document that came from headquarters, and try to convince her to work for us.
This was a specific government operation designed to prevent free speech. The goal was to stop the HBO documentary. And if they destroyed Linda's reputation in the process, even better.
I'm going to do this HBO documentary. She was trying to confirm all the information is what it sounded like. So you were tasked with basically putting the kibosh on that documentary.
Yeah, that was Operation Kensaw. I interviewed her and, you know, showed her the documents and so forth, providing her with something that was detrimental to HBO. Another OSI agent provided her with a small film clip.
Was it real or fake?
It was fake. It discredited her, and therefore she lost that contract.
The project was canceled, and Linda's reputation as a mainstream filmmaker was damaged. This was how the game was played. Promise evidence, build trust, then pull the rug out.
They're working for my government. They're working in agencies of the government that is supposed to be protecting of the people, by the people, for the people. How did it all turn upside down?
HBO canceled the show because of Doty?
Yep.
I wish Doty was around for the last season of Game of Thrones.
In June 1989, the UFO community gathered in Las Vegas for the annual MUFON conference. Bill Moore was scheduled to speak. Moore was now a hero for his work on the MJ-12 documents. The room was packed. The last thing anyone expected to hear was a confession. Bill Moore, maybe the most trusted UFO researcher in the world, was a government asset. His handler was Richard Doty. They had an arrangement. Doty would provide Moore with confidential information about UFOs. Moore would report on the activities of people like Paul Benowitz and others in the UFO community.
And it was Richard Doty, then with AFOSI at Kirtland Air Force Base, who soon came into play as the middleman in that process. Shortly thereafter, it became apparent to me that my supplying information to the government through Doty on the activities of Paul Benowitz, APO, and to a lesser extent, several other individuals was to be a part of this equation.
Not only did Moore spread government disinformation, but he would also report back on how well the lies performed.
The entire story of a secret treaty between the U.S. government and the aliens, of exchanges of technology between us and the aliens, of battles between aliens and American armed forces, and of aliens allegedly having implanted hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of human beings for the purpose of taking over the world and using us as cattle or slaves, came about as a result of the disinformation process. I know, because I was in a position to observe much of this process as it unfolded, and I was providing regular reports on its effectiveness to some of the very people who were doing it to Paul.
I recruited Bill Moore. I recruited him to be a spy within the UFO community.
The room erupted. Researchers who trusted him felt betrayed. The man who brought the MJ-12 documents to the world had just admitted he was a government operative. His career was over. He was booed off the stage. Moore's confession cast a shadow over everything. Were the MJ documents just another part of the game? A sophisticated piece of disinformation?
Regarding the MJ-12 documents that were released to Jamie Shendir or Bill Moore, I had absolutely nothing to do with that. We coordinated, had the liaison with him.
But all these other copies spread out around. Of course, the internet wasn't in existence back then, but and that's how the MJ-12 documents. I would say that some of the information was factual and a lot of it wasn't.
There were some investigations conducted by FBI, OSI,
regarding the MJ-12 documents, extensive investigations, just to determine whether these things were legitimate, whether they contained classified information, and then who released them. So the names of the members of the MJ-12 group were not officially known to us. A lot of the information, not all the particular details, but a lot of the information is factual.
Who's controlling the release of information? There's a group out there that is. I can guarantee you that there is.
Now, the MJ-12 documents, entirely different. Those things surfaced through a guy by the name of Jamie Shandira. He got them. I'm sure, I'm almost convinced, that was part of another operation.
The MJ-12, are they MJ-12? Where did they come from? Who makes up the MJ-12? What's their names today? Is it the Zodiac or Zenith Group or...
In 1987, I was investigated by the FBI for the MJ-12 documents. They claimed, the UFO researchers claimed I released them, I created them.
And we also wanted to form an alliance with the MJ-12 group, working either alongside them or working with them.
I have no connections, official connections with the United States government or intelligence community.
And those documents were created based on actual documents.
So you have to give them a little bit of real information before you throw in the disinformation. And then you add more and more and more, and that person opens their mind up and says, you know what, I think this is all real.
Everything about MJ-12 was now thrown into doubt. The documents were scrutinized. Believers became skeptics. The story was pushed to the fringe. But in 1994, another Majestic 12 document was found, and this was so detailed, it was almost impossible to deny. William Moore's confession had shattered the UFO community. The MJ-12 documents, once seen as the Holy Grail, were now tainted by disinformation, and Richard Doty's fingerprints were all over it.
These fingerprints were on the taint.
Stop that.
Yeah.
Researchers were divided. Then in 1994, 10 years after the first package arrived, another roll of film was sent. This time the recipient was Don Berliner, a respected aviation journalist. The film wasn't a memo or a briefing. It was a field guide. The cover read, Majestic 12 Group Special Operations Manual, with the subtitle, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology, Recovery, and Disposal. It was dated April 1954 and marked Top Secret, Magic Eyes Only. For researchers, this was the Rosetta Stone, a step-by-step guide for managing an alien presence on Earth. The level of detail was staggering. It provided instructions for establishing a secure perimeter around a crash site. It outlined protocols for handling various types of alien technology.
Craft are to be approached with extreme caution if they appear functional, as serious injury may result from exposure to radiation and electrical discharges. If the craft is functioning but appears to be abandoned, it may be approached only by specially trained MJ-12 Red Team personnel wearing protective clothing. Complete craft and parts of crafts too large to be transported by covered transport will be disassembled. If they must be transported whole or on open flatbed trailers, they will be covered in such a manner as to camouflage their shape.
The guide specified packaging and shipping procedures, press blackouts, how to issue deceptive statements to the media, how to discredit witnesses, and communication protocols to follow if live contact was established.
In dealing with any living extraterrestrial biological entity, security is of paramount importance. All other considerations are secondary. Although it is preferable to maintain the physical well-being of any entity, the loss of EBE life is considered acceptable if conditions or delays to preserve that life in any way compromises the security of the operations. Remains will be preserved against further decomposition as equipment and conditions permit. Cadavers and remains will be bagged or securely wrapped in waterproof coverings. Remains will be refrigerated or packed with ice if available.
The manual described four types of alien craft in precise detail, disks between 50 and 300 feet wide, cigar-shaped vessels over 2,000 feet long, cone and triangle-shaped craft. It also categorized two different types of EBEs. Type 1 entities were humanoid, about 5 feet tall, with pale yellow skin. Type 2 were 3 to 4 feet tall, with large elongated heads, with big slanted eyes that were pure black, pale skin, 3 long fingers, and a thumb. We know them as the Greys.
It is not definitely known where either type of creature originates, but it seems certain that they did not evolve on Earth. It is further evident, although not certain, that they may have originated on two different planets.
The manual was clinical and professional, exactly what you'd expect from a military field guide. It answered every question critics raised about earlier MJ-12 documents, almost as if someone was paying attention and responding to skeptics, and maybe somebody was. Page 2 identified the source of the document, Kirtland Air Force Base, Albuquerque, New Mexico, headquarters of OSI agent Richard Doty. Researchers found what looked like top-secret documents proving a UFO cover-up. They followed a paper trail to a smoking gun in the National Archives. But the investigation collapsed when one of their own confessed to being a government disinformation agent. But are the Majestic 12 documents real? Well, let's break it down. The case for a hoax is overwhelming. William Moore, the man at the center of the discovery, publicly admitted to working with Air Force intelligence to spread disinformation. The documents were mailed to him and Jamie Chanderay with no chain of custody. Later, they found the Cutler-Twining memo in the National Archives. Skeptics say they planted it there, which I believe they did. The documents themselves are full of problems. The Cutler-Twining memo was signed by Robert Cutler on a date he wasn't in the country. Other documents use a strange date format that isn't used by the military or civilians, like putting 06 instead of just 6 for the day of the month. The typefaces are a little wrong for the early 1950s. There are formatting errors, misspellings, and terminology problems, like using the word media instead of the press, which was much more common. There are references to buildings that didn't exist yet. The documents were missing proper top secret control numbers. President Truman's signature was obviously copied from another document. So is it a hoax? Well, not so fast. The film containing the Special Operations Manual was authenticated as 1950s era Tri-X stock. Forensic analysis of the typography showed a raised letter Z. This was an artifact of a 1954 hot lead printing press. That's a nice detail. The language is correct. Terms like craft tape instead of duct tape, and the official 1950s postal abbreviation for New Mexico, N.MEX. It was perfect. Almost. The font and use of bold section headers aren't consistent with DoD field manuals. It refers to Area 51. Area 51 wasn't publicly acknowledged until 2013. Besides, the military didn't call it Area 51. That was a CIA designation. The manual outlines procedures for satellite recovery, but this is supposed to be from 1954. Sputnik wasn't launched until 1957, and it caught America by surprise. Still, there are coincidences that are hard to dismiss. President Truman really did meet with Bush and Forrestal on the exact day the MJ-12 order was supposedly signed. General Twining's flight logs really do place him in New Mexico right after the crash. And Dr. Menzel really did have top secret ultra clearance with the CIA. So what's going on? Are the documents fake or real? Well, the answer is yes. All roads lead back to Kirtland Air Force Base, the Office of Special Investigations, and Richard Doty. This wasn't a random hoax. It was a coordinated psychological operation. The goal was to fool the public and control the researchers. By feeding them a mix of fake and real information, they waste time following false leads. They waste time studying fictional details. And they waste time arguing with each other about who was or wasn't an intelligence asset. If anyone got too close to an actual secret, the intelligence community would steer the narrative and discredit them. Smear campaigns were effective.
Yeah, pushing people out of windows works too.
It sure does. I think the truth about Majestic 12 is more mundane. The documents were designed to confuse researchers while the military tested special equipment and operated black projects in the desert. Are they testing reverse-engineered alien craft? Probably, though it's probably not what we think. Do I believe an organization operating outside the government is controlling the UFO narrative? Absolutely I do. this rabbit hole goes even deeper, which is why this is only volume one of a series of Majestic 12 episodes. The documents are forgeries, but they're really good forgeries. Doty's become the face of UFO disinformation, but he was just one small piece of a very large, very well-funded machine. Doty himself said the documents weren't real, but a lot of the information in them is. He's careful about how he words that. The real conspiracy is that the techniques perfected on UFO researchers in the 1980s are now being used on all of us every single day. Are the current whistleblowers telling the truth? I doubt it. I don't trust people from Air Force intelligence with active security clearances, giving statements approved by the Pentagon, all while getting paid by the U.S. government. And I become really skeptical when you release a book.
There's always a book.
But I could be wrong. When I publicly denounce the whistleblowers, half my audience cheers and the other half boos. We're divided. As I'm writing this, people are debating whether the Tic Tac UFO is a Lockheed project. They're divided and distracted. And that's the point. The weaponization of truth didn't end with Majestic 12. That's when it began. It was a field test. In an age of social media and information warfare, we're all Paul Benowitz now. We're constantly targeted, manipulated, and fed a version of reality designed to keep us confused and divided. But don't let them win. We'll only learn the truth when we're focused and united. We have to apply pressure on our elected officials. We need them to be afraid. We need them to know that if you lie to us, you're fired. Also, if you do nothing, you're fired. Every election cycle, we need to hold them accountable. If they fail, we go to the ballot box and drop a hammer on them. Then we bring in somebody else to get the job done. If they fail, drop the hammer. Again and again and again. We need to be as relentless as they are. We're outgunned. They have all the tools of the state at their disposal. All we have is a hammer. But you know what they say when all you have is a hammer? Well, when I look at Capitol Hill, I see a whole bunch of nails. Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ. There's Hagglefish.
Faggy Beefy.
This has been The Wyatt Files. If you had fun or learned anything, I'd really appreciate it if you subscribe, like, comment, share. That stuff helps the channel, I think. Like most topics we cover on the channel, today's was recommended by you, by thousands of you. If there's a story you'd like to see or learn more about, go to thewyattfiles.com/tips. And there are more Majestic 12 episodes coming. You are not going to believe this rabbit hole. Now remember, The Wyatt Files is also a podcast. You could take us on the road. Twice a week, I post deep dives into the stories we cover on the channel. I also post episodes that wouldn't be allowed on the channel. Those are labeled redacted. It's called The Wyatt Files Operation Podcast, and it's available everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you're listening, do us a favor and hit whatever button you need to hit. That stuff really does help on the podcast platforms. Now, if you need more Wyatt Files in your life, see a doctor. No. Check out our Discord. There are thousands of people on there 24/7. They're into the same weird stuff we are. They're always talking about these crazy topics. It's a great community. It's really supportive. It's a lot of fun, and it's free to join. And speaking of 24/7, make sure you check out our 24/7 stream on the Wyatt Files Backstage. Over there, we run episodes back-to-back with some fun content in between. Actually, the live chat is more entertaining than the videos. Now, if you want to know what's going on with the Wyatt Files, check out our production calendar. It's thewyattfiles.com/cal. There we post our episode schedule, upcoming podcasts, live streams, all that stuff. Special thanks to our patrons who made this channel possible and made this episode happen. Every episode of The Wyatt Files is dedicated to our Patreon members. I couldn't do this without you, and I thank you for sticking with me this long. And if you'd like to keep us going, support the channel, consider becoming a member on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you get access to perks like videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch only available to members, plus 2 private live streams every week just for you. And the whole Wyatt Files team is on the stream, and you could turn your webcam on, jump up on stage, tell a joke, ask a question, discuss a topic, whatever you want to do. It's a great way to get to know us as people. I think it's the best perk there is. Another great way to support the channel is grab something from the Wyatt Files store.
I grab a heck of a t-shirt, one of these fistable coffee mugs, and you can stick your top secret fist in, or your fin, or whatever you got hanging off your torso to answer to my concern what you do with your fist. Grab a hoodie or something my face on it. Get one of these weird YouTube styles. I think we still have those in stock. I gotta check with Victoria. Grab a squeezy animal. Hagglefish talking dollfish.
But if you're going to buy merch, make sure you become a member on YouTube. YouTube members get 10% off everything on the Wyatt Files store forever. You get a new code every month, and it only costs $3. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts, get the code and it pays for itself. And then if you want to cancel, you can cancel. It's not a way for me to make money. The membership is a way for you to make money. Besides, all that money goes to my great team.
Yeah, but keep that secret under your tinfoil hat, would you?
Those are the plugs. They get longer every week. Anyway, that's going to do it. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated.
A secret code inside the Bible said I would. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. I got stuck inside Mel's home with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing alone on a film set? Or were the shadow people there? The Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man, I'm told. And his name was Cold. And I can't believe I'm dancing with the the solar storm still come to a god, the secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found. In a simulation, don't you worry though, the Black Knight satellite, it told me so. I can't believe